This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents The Bone Farm, a Jane Hawke case file by Dean Koontz. Performed by Elizabeth Rogers and James Anderson Foster.
One.
I've never killed anyone, Gary Burkett said. Have you ever killed anyone?
Not yet, said Jane Hawke. Wounded a couple.
Do you think you're capable of killing someone?
I better be. So would you. She drove fast, eager to conduct the final interview of the day, and then head home to Alexandria, which would be a 3-hour drive. She had been away from her husband, Nick, and her boy, Travis, for 3 days, and although she took great satisfaction in her work, she loved her family more. The long shadows strained toward the east, as if yearning to join the wave of night that would soon break across that horizon. Small towns and smaller hamlets, dairy farms where herds of cows ambled barnward at day's end, cornfields cut to stubble, readied for the hitch and harrow. The drone of the Suburban's tires on the county two-lane was a monotonous song of weariness. This had been a grim and tedious day in a bucolic landscape. However, she reminded herself, tedium can become terror from one moment to the next.
I'm 32, Gary said. Been in the Bureau 9 years, a lot longer than you, and never doubted I could kill a bad guy if it came to that, but something's different now that...
Now that what?
Now that I'm going to be a father.
His wife, Rosalind, was 5 months pregnant.
If I have to kill someone, what will my daughter think of that when she's grown up and has her own opinions?
She's going to be an FBI kid, Gary. She'll understand bad guys and how they sometimes have to be stopped cold.
Probably she will. But you never know about kids.
Half the early September sky was ablaze, and across the other half, sapphire blue darkled toward black as the stars prepared to come on stage. Assigned to the Critical Incident Response Group, she and Gary were in South Central Pennsylvania, interviewing family and friends of a kidnapped 20-year-old college student. Catherine Haskell was the 22nd victim of a serial killer whom the worst of the tabloid press had labeled the mother-hater. She'd disappeared 6 days earlier. 3 days after she went missing, her mother received an envelope postmarked Cumberland, Maryland. It contained a photograph of Kathy on a wooden stool in front of a sky-blue wall. She was naked and looked terrified. 21 other mothers had received photos of their daughters within a week of their disappearance, postmarked in a variety of northeastern cities and states. A second photo came between 2 and 4 months later. The missing girl, again naked, but now brutalized and dead, lying on bare earth as if on the brink of a grave. However ruthlessly the killer had used Kathy during the past 6 days, at least she wasn't dead. He didn't kill them until he tired of them. The high-quality photos were not embedded with any smartphone signifiers. They were taken with a camera, but the Bureau lab could not identify the manufacturer. The brand of photographic paper was sold in 49 of the 50 states. No fingerprints. The self-sealing envelopes didn't require the sender to lick the glue line, which eliminated the possibility of finding DNA material from dried saliva. The killer had access to a photographic lab, but it was likely a small in-home hobby setup, untraceable. Months of investigation of commercial labs and photographers had turned up nothing of value.
Are you sure your boy would understand you're killing someone?
Travis is 3, Gary. He's not yet brooding about justifiable homicide.
But you're confident he'll understand when he grows up?
Yes, because Nick and I will teach him how the world really works, Not how some people wish it worked. Just like you and Rosalind will teach your daughter. The voice of the GPS assured them that they had arrived at Gossage Farm, and Jane turned right onto the long private drive that led to the house. Overhanging oaks roofed a lane of oiled earth. She switched on the headlights. The trees were only partly dressed in autumn color, still more green than purple-red. None of the first 21 victims had been snatched in Pennsylvania. They had vanished from places in Ohio, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, and West Virginia. The youngest had been 15, the oldest, 23. At first, it had seemed significant that the mother-hater had begun hunting in new territory. But interviews with those who knew Kathy, coupled with the details of her life and disappearance, had turned up not a single fact that suggested anything different about the killer's choice of this victim, nothing that might lead them to him. Exactly where she had disappeared was not known. Her car, a 10-year-old Honda, remained missing. 3 days among the girl's grieving loved ones had left a grayness in Jane's soul and a secondhand sorrow in her heart. The handsome house at the end of the oak-shaded lane faced west, so that by reflection the burning portion of the sky rouged the clapboard that would be white in daylight. Mercer Gossage, a cousin of Kathy Haskell's mother, Anita, must have heard the suburban approaching. He waited on the porch. A tall, imposing man of 44, country royalty. The 300-acre farm had passed from his grandfather to his father and, just 5 years earlier, to Mercer through his widowed mother's will. He welcomed Gary Burkett and Jane up the porch steps and shook their hands. His smile was sewn through with a sadness, also apparent in his blue eyes, but he seemed naturally cordial and perhaps could not, by his very constitution, imagine introducing himself without a smile, even in solemn situations.
I brewed a fresh pot of coffee. I warn you, it is to Starbucks what grapefruit juice is to Dom Perignon, but you're welcome to it. If you'll just follow me through to the kitchen, we can do this there.
Jane didn't want coffee. In fact, she felt that they were to some small extent surrendering control of the interview by accepting Gossage's hospitality. But before she could decline, Gary said he could use a cup. 4 grandfather clocks stood along the ground floor hallway, pendulums swinging, mechanisms softly clicking away the seconds.
My mother collected antique clocks, Gossage said. Long case clocks like these, but also bracket clocks, carriage clocks, mantel clocks. For the longest time, I thought it was a little batty, but then, slowly, I began to appreciate the beauty of them. And now I'm just as much a clock nut as she was.
Through archways to the living room and dining room, Jane saw overdone, indeed fussy, Victorian decor and fireplaces that each bore 3 large clocks. Beyond the open door to a study were walls lined with shelves on which stood a small fortune in antique clocks, ornate gilt bronze and buhl and tole and porcelain clocks. The contemporary-style kitchen featured white cabinets, black granite counters, and modern appliances, but 2 grandfather clocks flanked the back door, each with a marquetry case, exotic wood inlays depicting elaborate floral designs.
William and Mary Long Cases by John Wise, Gossage said of the clocks. Late 17th century.
Jane was a pianist and understood the passion for collecting, whether clocks or, in her case, vinyl recordings of piano masters like Arthur Rubinstein and Glenn Gould. However, sometimes passion could metastasize into obsession, and when that happened, there was the possibility that the collection was a symptom of one kind of mental disorder or another. The aroma of fresh-brewed coffee was so appealing that Jane did not object when Gossage poured 3 cups rather than 2. Gary Burkett said,
"So many clocks and so little ticking."
"Oh, said Gossage as the three of them sat at the table.
Mom and I muffled the mechanisms. Otherwise, I would have ended up in a madhouse. Well, maybe I did, after all. I had a 10-year career in politics.
At 26, he had been elected to the County Board of Supervisors. At 30, he was chairman of it. Following that, he'd been elected to the state legislature. Some, including his cousin Anita Haskell, were among those who thought he might one day be governor. Considering that the man had such charisma and an appealing habit of self-deprecation, Jane wondered, "Why did you give it up?" He frowned and shook his head.
"There are so few people in that world with honor, so many driven by greed or a lust for power. You never know who to trust. I was naive when I got into it. Eventually, I didn't have the stomach for politics." "Good coffee," said Gary.
Gossage smiled.
"No offense intended, Agent Burkett, but the way you say that with a straight face, maybe you'd do all right in politics."
In fact, the coffee was excellent. And the way Gossage modestly disclaimed the praise struck Jane as entirely political. "Your cousin Anita says you understood Kathy as well as anyone, that you literally turned the girl's life around when she went off the rails at 14.
"Anita credits me too much. She's a single mom, but a great one. Kathy was just in rebellion. Disobedience was her identity. Hanging with the wrong crowd, a pothead boyfriend. I've told Anita 100 times it was hardly me at all. It was mainly Lenore, my mother, who got through to Kathy back then, got her back on the rails. This was a year before Mom died. She was 69, but young at heart. Kathy loved my mom. Nearly everyone did."
The following is a compilation of extracts from the journal of Mercer Gossage, begun when he was 14, in which he never refers to himself as I, only by his name and as he.
Mercer has long suffered anxiety regarding his hateful father. Mercer suffers because he has a very great destiny. A very great destiny requires suffering in preparation for it. Mother says Mercer has a great destiny, and Mother can't lie because she is love. She is pure love. She says pure love cannot lie. Mercer's father, Vernon, is one of those rare people who do not love Mercer's saintly mother, Lenore. But then Vernon doesn't love anyone. He is a distant, icy man who seems happiest, if he is ever happy, when he's engaged in some endeavor alone, fishing or hunting or horseback riding. Vernon's meager capacity for affection is reserved for his horses and his pickup truck. Vernon does not seem to love his only child. Mercer suspects this by the time he is 6, and when Mercer asks Mother if his father loves him, she says, "Your daddy loves himself so much that he doesn't have any left over for anyone else." Lenore has always showered Mercer with a mother's love, cuddles and pets him as she might a beloved dog if she liked dogs. And after she answers his question about his father, she takes 6-year-old Mercer into her arms, but also into her confidence to a greater and most remarkable extent. From that day forward, she shares with Mercer every selfish act committed by Vernon, every meanness and insult and lie, every act of infidelity. Vernon has other women, and he doesn't care if Lenore knows it. Indeed, Vernon tells her about them in the most vicious and taunting manner. By the time Mercer is 10, he is also privy to every intimate turn of his mother's life. He knows specifically how his father uses her in bed, how he hurts her and humiliates her, and knows no limits to his cruelty. This makes Mercer angry, so angry that Mercer wants to hurt his father. But his loving mother cuddles him and pets him, gentling him, because anger harms no one but the person who harbors it. She is the best mother. She is the best mother in the world, and so patient with her hateful husband. She is not angry with Vernon, only sad and terribly hurt. Many is the night when, home alone together, Mercer and Mother have a good long cry over the terrible suffering that she endures. Vernon has been willed the farm by his father, but Lenore's inheritance and the income it spins off make it possible for Vernon to forego farming and devote himself to fishing, hunting, horseback riding, and serial adultery. He is shit. Mercer's father is a piece of shit. From time to time, he sells off a parcel of land and, over the years, diminishes the property from 500 acres to 300. But the money he receives is spent on his whores and other pleasures. He is a whoremonger, and he has no shame, while, like a leech, he lives off Mother's investment income. She worries that one day he will have sold off all the land and will have impoverished them with his gambling debts. But she is afraid to leave him for fear that he will harm her and Mercer. She often recounts for Mercer the threats that Vernon has made to kill them both and free himself from marriage and fatherhood. Mercer is blessed to have such a mother who cherishes him and tells him only truths, even the hard truths about his father and her suffering. She devotes herself tirelessly to Mercer and homeschools him to keep him safe, for he can never be safe in either public or private schools where there are boys of the worst character, young wolves. Mercer would be so alone without her. Even with Mother here for him whenever he needs her, Mercer sometimes feels desperately alone, lost and alone, as though he is the last person on earth. He steps outside and runs into the yard and turns in a circle, and there is no one in sight. The hundreds of unworked acres all around, no traffic noises even from a distance, no sound except the breeze whispering through the trees. The sky empty and the land fallow. He fears that time has stopped, that there is no future anymore, that nothing will change, that he is trapped alone in this moment, pinned to this one eternal minute, pinned like a butterfly to a collector's board. When that mood overcomes him and a quiet panic begins to rise in Mercer's blood, he runs to Mother. She calms him, reassures him that he is not alone and never will be as long as she lives. When Mercer's 16, Father is thrown by a horse and dies of a broken neck. Neither Mercer nor Mother grieves, but in fact, they celebrate with cake and ice cream as though it is a birthday, not a death day. The hateful whoremonger is dead. The whoremonger is dead, dead and will always be dead. After that, everything is perfect. Peace and pure love and happiness. Lenore continues to homeschool Mercer, and they are never apart. The two of them stand together against the wicked world, and oh, the world is dark and populated by predatory people who would steal every dime from a widow and her child, leaving them homeless and starving. But they are safe as long as they have each other and only each other. Mercer has no need of a girlfriend. A girlfriend would only be the female equivalent of his father, a dirty slut who would betray him with any man who wanted her. No woman can be trusted as Mother can be trusted. Mercer has a very great destiny, and nothing can destroy his great destiny sooner than a dirty little slut who will cuckold him and hold him up to public ridicule. To relieve Mercer of the need for a girl of his own, 5 years ago, when he was 11, Lenore showed him what any boy can do for himself in the privacy of his room to make a girl unnecessary. Ever since, by mail, she has purchased for Mercer thrilling magazines, then even more thrilling videos, and eventually DVD movies to facilitate his erotic fantasies and spare him the mortal danger of real girls. When Mercer is 26, he runs for a seat on the county board of supervisors and wins, for the sole purpose of shepherding through certain land use changes that will increase the value of his precious mother's property, so she will never again have to worry about becoming destitute. When he goes away to the state legislature for a similar purpose, he still comes home from Harrisburg 6 nights a week. During 2 years in Harrisburg, he achieves what Mother needs from the state government, and he is through with politics, which is a dirty business better suited to the late Vernon Gossage than to his son, who has never been with whores and never will be. Mercer never spends another night away from home. He is 39 when Mother dies of a stroke. Mercer feels as though a part of himself has perished as well. Something inside him, at the very center of him, has imploded and blackened and taken upon itself the gravity of a dead star. Mercer puts on a very brave front publicly, but cries himself to sleep night after night. His grief is nearly disabling, and the loss so embitters him that he considers torturing and killing her physician, who damn well should have recognized the threat to that precious woman. The hateful doctor is incompetent, or worse, he is a dirty whoremonger like Vernon. He is a whoremonger and hated Mother for the purity of her love. However, as Mother taught him, anger only harms the one who harbors it. So Mercer must gentle himself. The dense, dead star at the center of Mercer is pulling him into its absolute darkness. But Mercer smiles and puts on a brave front. As Mother taught him, it is at all times essential to put on a brave front, to hide one's fears and truest feelings, because this sad world is full of wolves in human clothing, wolves who will exploit your every fear and weakness until they destroy you. The 5 months following Mother's death are grim, a test of Mercer's ability to maintain self-control and prepare for his great destiny. As hasn't happened in many years, he now again and often finds himself standing in the yard, turning in a circle, alone and lost under the empty sky, in all that fallow land, the last human being on earth, pinned to this eternal minute, with no future forthcoming. But then everything changes dramatically one day when he answers the doorbell and finds that he has come calling on himself. Mercer Gossage faces Mercer Gossage through the screen door, one of them in the foyer, the other on the porch.
3. Flying hard-shell beetles clicked against the kitchen windows in pursuit of light. Tall, muffled clocks chased the future second by second. Mercer Gossage stirred his coffee rather than drink it, clinking the spoon against the cup, stirred not to cool the coffee, because the coffee was already cool enough to sip, but as though he wanted to transform the brew into something else. He spoke movingly of the kidnapped girl, Kathy Haskell, of her mother's pain on receiving the photograph sent by the killer. His grief seemed genuine and profound, unshed tears in his eyes. Yet Jane Hawke found him vaguely disturbing. He directly met their eyes and answered all their questions about Kathy and the bad crowd that she had hung with for a while when she had been 14. He didn't seem in any way evasive or insincere or nervous, except for how he kept stirring the coffee. Sometimes he looked down at the cup for a minute or so, nearly always when emotion threatened to get the better of him. Perhaps he'd known he would inevitably be shaken by grief. He spoke of Kathy and her parents with such fondness, and had wanted the coffee only as a distraction toward which he could shift his attention when he needed to collect himself. Yes. Perhaps. But perhaps not. More often than not, when he lowered his gaze to the cup and the tireless spoon, he glanced surreptitiously at his wristwatch, as if impatient with the passage of time and eager for an end to their questions. The William and Mary long cases flanking the back door were behind Gossage. When again he furtively consulted his watch, Jane looked past him at those tall clocks and realized that they didn't present the same time. In fact, as the minute hand of that to the left of the door softly clicked forward one check, the comparable hand on that to the right of the door simultaneously clicked backward one check. "One of those clocks is running backward," she said. Raising his eyes from his coffee, Gossage managed an expression of melancholy amusement.
"Yes, that's right. My mother, Lenore, was the dearest woman. But she had her superstitions."
Gary Burkett frowned.
"What superstition is satisfied by jiggering a clock to run backward?" "Mother was superstitious, and, I regret to say, afflicted with just the littlest bit of dementia in her last years. She convinced herself that if some clocks were counting forward while others counted backward, then time would stand still in this house, so she wouldn't age further and wouldn't die."
"Are you saying that half of all the clocks in this place are rigged to run backward?" Gary asked.
Jane said nothing, but watched intently as Gossage shrugged his big shoulders and summoned again that smile of melancholy amusement.
"It's a lot of clocks, I'll grant you. But it meant so much to her, and she meant so much to me. I didn't mind all the tinkering with them. It made her happy."
"That's very sweet," Jane said, though she didn't think it was sweet at all, but perhaps indicative of obsession. "How long ago did your mother pass, Mr. Gossage?"
4 years, 6 months, almost to the day.
4.
Mercer stares at himself through the screen door. For a moment, certain this is how death visits those he reaps, not in a hooded black robe and carrying a wicked scythe, but as the very image of the person whose life he has come to end, as if to say, "You exist now in me, no longer in the world." Mercer never knew he had an identical twin. The resemblance is remarkable. Although they haven't met until now, Mercer and his double dress in similar clothes and even sport similar hairstyles. If one of them weighs a few pounds more than the other, the eye cannot detect the heavier of the two. The fateful visitor's name is Jack Crockett, and he has been seeking his twin brother for 3 years, in spite of the resistance of the church-associated adoption agency and authorities. His skill as a computer hacker and his disdain for laws and protocols have served him well in the search. Jack brings with him a bottle of Macallan Scotch to celebrate their reunion. The choice of this fine whiskey is extraordinary. Mother did not approve the consumption of alcohol. While Lenore was alive, Mercer respected her wishes and did not imbibe. Since her death, however, Mercer has taken consolation in Scotch, and it is this very brand that he drinks. They adjourn to the kitchen, where each takes 2 fingers of whiskey. Neat. Mercer first assumes that Mother delivered twins and that his hateful father, who had no use for children, would not tolerate 2 of them in the house. But the truth is different and devastating. Mercer is not his mother's child. He is adopted. Both he and Jack are the children of a former prostitute named Brandy Wines, who put them both up for adoption. Brandy still lives,
Jack found her before he found Mercer. Because Brandy used birth control when with a John, but not when in bed with her main man, a pimp named Dewey Gorton, that whoremaster is almost certainly their father. If pure love cannot lie, which Mother often told Mercer, then she, Lenore, was not pure love, as she claimed. Mother deceived him about the most fundamental things, his origin, his heritage, and she encouraged all her relatives to cooperate with her in this shocking deception. Mother lied to Mercer as well about his great destiny, which she had never defined. With my guidance, my lovely boy, you've kept yourself pure, allowed no girl to seduce you, which has prepared you for a great destiny. It isn't for me to say what that destiny might be, although I know. Oh, my dear child, I know, but it is for you to discover. I must never rob you of the delight, the joy that will come with the surprise of discovering your great destiny. However, Mercer is the child of a whore and a pimp, raised by a liar, and he can't see how someone with roots as twisted as his can grow into a great destiny. He is 39, and alone, and waiting for a great destiny that does not exist. Mercer has never been an angry person. Mother smoothed away his anger each time that it arose, cuddled and petted him as she might have gentled a beloved dog if she liked dogs. But she didn't like dogs, and maybe she didn't like Mercer very much either. Maybe she manipulated and used him, lied and manipulated and used. The black hole that has existed at the core of him ever since Mother died, the dense, dead star of depression, slowly begins to change in character. It becomes a simmering anger. Mercer is frightened by the potential of that anger to fester and grow. Jack Crockett has no problem with anger. He thrives on it. He didn't take well to his adopted family and hasn't seen them since he was 17. He was his father's son and proud of it. His research has shown him that the late Dewey Gorton was a badass dude who took what he wanted and did what he wanted. And anyone who got in his way regretted crossing him. Jack pours another two fingers of scotch for each of them. Sitting at the kitchen table, listening to his brother, Mercer feels that not only has he been lied to, but also has lived a lie his entire life. Mercer has never known who he really is, has not been allowed to know. Jack is colorful. Jack is funny. Jack has known many adventures, much excitement. Jack has been everywhere and has endless colorful stories to tell. Jack takes no shit from anyone. Jack is the Mercer that Mercer was never given the chance to be. Jack will stay with Mercer for a while. He must stay. They have to get to know each other. For months, Mercer has not been able to see his future or to find any way to get there. Jack Crockett is a door to the future. When Jack brings his luggage and a lot of photography gear in from his white Chevy van, he also brings a girl named Danica. Mercer was not aware that she had been waiting in the vehicle. She is in her early 20s, slim but full-breasted. Blonde hair, green eyes, she moves with the grace of light. Mercer cannot stop looking at her. She is as desirable as any of the hot girls in the thrilling magazines and movies that his mother bought for him over the years, beginning when he was not yet quite 12. Jack and Danica sleep in Mercer's old room because shortly after Mother's death, Mercer had taken to sleeping in her bed. On the third night after the brothers begin to share the house, Mercer awakens when Danica turns back the covers and, naked, slips into Mother's bed. Surely she has had too much to drink, has confused the rooms, and believes she is bedding down with the twin who brought her. But she says, Jack sent me. He thinks you need this. Sometimes Mercer has awakened in the night, sure that Mother's spirit haunts this bedroom. Coupling with Danica is an exorcism. The next day, Mercer and Danica do not come downstairs until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, whereupon Mercer discovers that Jack has been working on some of the clocks to make them run backward. Until now, Mercer hasn't noticed that Jack wears two wristwatches. The first counts time forward while the hands on the second move steadily counterclockwise. One of the exotic places that Jack knows well is New Orleans, where he met an old black woman, Mama Dede Labrique, who not only practices voodoo but is queen of a cult. She gave him this watch that breaks the basic rule of all clocks. On the back of the casing is engraved a voodoo veve. According to Mama Dede Labrique, wearing her watch on one wrist and an ordinary watch on the other ensures that Jack will live at least to 113 in perfect health, possibly forever, and that until his last day he will perform sexually as though he is 18. Jack says, Man, with all these clocks, if half are running forward and half backward, this whole house will be a place outside of time, and no one in it will ever age. It's like my destiny to find you and be here. My destiny, bro, and yours. At that moment, Mercer decides that no one must know Jack is here. The situation is magical, yes, magical. It is a very magical situation, as though another, more exciting version of himself stepped out of a looking glass and brought with him a princess, and the magic can best be sustained in secrecy.
5. Only Gary Burkett drank the coffee. Mercer Gossage stirred his ceaselessly, and after a single sip, Jane let hers get cold. When Gossage said that his mother had been dead 4 years and 6 months, Jane said, And you haven't fixed all these backward-running clocks in all that time? Gossage selected a wistful version from his deep catalog of charming smiles. The clocks running backward. They remind me how cute Mother was, how sweet. They make me smile. Jane pushed aside her cold coffee. Didn't you say your mother made you jigger the clocks after she began to suffer from dementia? Just a touch of dementia. Mother never got really bad. She always knew who she was. Mother always knew exactly who she was. You're made of better stuff than I am, Jane said. When my grandmother suffered dementia, I couldn't deal with it. This was a lie. She had no grandmother with dementia. I wanted to remember her only as she had been before her mind started to go. But you want to remember all of it, before and after. Although Jane had phrased her response as vague praise, Gossage detected the underlying suggestion that she found his maintenance of the backward-running clocks curious. He stopped stirring his coffee and used his right hand to pull thoughtfully on his chin, his gaze seeming to fix on a faraway shore, as if she inspired him to some philosophical consideration.
It is a bit strange, I suppose. Maybe I'm too slow to let go. After all, it's been nearly 5 years.
4 years, 6 months, almost to the day, Jane quoted him.
The clocks are beautiful and quite valuable, Gossage said. I really should put them right. Maybe even sell some. After all, half as many would still keep her memory alive here.
His gaze returned from elsewhere, and he made a little production of noticing Gary's empty cup.
You like the coffee, Agent Burkett? Yes, sir. Excellent. Feel free to help yourself to more.
Gossage gestured toward the coffee maker.
I believe I will, Gary said, rising from his chair. Agent Hawk, would you like to warm yours?
No, thank you. Caffeine makes me eat acid reducers like candy. Gossage had called his father a hard man. His mother seemed to have had her problems, too. Evil breeds in dysfunctional families, a truth Jane had known since she was 9. Her father, Martin Duroc, was a famous concert pianist. Women were drawn to him, and he wanted them all. Regretting his marriage, he killed Jane's mother, Vanessa, and staged it as a suicide. Young Jane had known he'd done it, but she'd found it difficult to believe what she knew, too confused and afraid to speak up. If her mother had shared with her the truth of Martin's many betrayals, 9-year-old Jane might have been better prepared to face facts and to bear witness against her father when evidence might have existed to corroborate her accusations. Now, Vanessa was long dead, while Martin performed to standing ovations. He looked at his full cup, and, Jane believed, was sincerely surprised to find that he had not touched it. Perhaps he realized that ceaselessly stirring it had made him look nervous.
I like it cool, he said to explain himself.
He drank from the cup with feigned pleasure, but Jane saw him flinch slightly at the taste. 6.
When Jack first says he believes that Mama Dede Labrique's claim about backward-running clocks is true, that this house can be made to exist outside of time and allow them to live forever, Mercer wonders about his brother's sanity. However, he professes interest in Mama Dede and says nothing critical because there is Danica to consider. If Jack leaves, so will Danica, and after one experience of the girl, Mercer is addicted to her. She is a vigorous partner in the bedroom, but also thrillingly submissive. Thereafter, day by day, everything around Mercer fades, and only Danica remains vividly real. He is in a thick fog of desire, and the girl is such a light unto him that, like a moth enchanted by the flame of a candle, Mercer would press himself upon her even if the contact might set him afire. For a week, she services the twins in their separate rooms. On the 7th night when Mercer is with her, he is not surprised when Jack enters Mother's former private chamber and joins them in a menage a trois. On some level, Mercer has known this is inevitable. There is no awkwardness, not even for a moment, because when Mercer looks at Jack with the girl between them, he is not looking at a strange man, but only at himself. Already Mercer and his brother anticipate each other's thoughts and finish each other's sentences. They were meant to be one, arising from a single egg fertilized by a single sperm, but the fertilized egg divided early in Brandywine's pregnancy. In the womb, they shared one amniotic sac and a single placenta, and now they share this woman, this house, one destiny. Jack supplies Danica with a variety of pills that she requires, and none is given for a medical reason. The pills generally sustain the girl in a buoyant mood, and for a few months she is mostly a delight to be around. Good at cards and other games, as funny as she is wildly erotic, quick to laugh, a good cook, never a nag, and always ready to be taken however they wish to take her. Jack photographs and makes videos of Danica. Looking at these makes Mercer feel as though he has stepped into one of those adult magazines or movies, into a life he has fantasized about ever since his mother introduced him to the world of eroticism. Mercer likes this feeling. He likes it very much. Danica occasionally has days when she is troubled by what she calls blue meanies. She becomes sullen, caustic, argumentative. She will not be touched. It is on one of these days that life at Gossage Farm takes a new turn, although it is no more of a surprise than was the moment when Jack joined Mercer and Danica in bed. In her blue meanies, Danica insults Jack once too often, refuses to have sex, and he hits her again. Mercer tries to stop Jack's assault by reminding him of the value that Danica has for them, but Jack is in a rage. Mercer has never seen anyone in such a rage. Jack scares him a little, which shouldn't be the case, because Jack is only Mercer himself, identical in all ways that matter. Jack says, "You think I've never had a bitch this hot? I've had dozens better than this, and they damn well don't say no to me. Aren't you bored with her, bro? I'm bored to death with the bitch. Variety, bro, variety, variety is the spice of life." Mercer does not want to participate in the beating of Danica, but he cannot look away. For some reason, Mercer cannot look away. Watching Jack beat the girl is like watching himself beat her, as though Mercer is standing outside of time, observing the life he might have lived if he hadn't lived the one as mother's pet. Jack is in a rage, a fury, but it doesn't seem to be the kind of anger that is harmful to the one who harbors it. Jack is clearly exhilarated in his rage. It is a happy anger. Jack even laughs as he curses Danica and hits her. Jack looks so powerful, as Mercer has never been. Jack doesn't accept rejection, doesn't take shit from anyone. His rage is like an act of nature, ferocious thunderstorm, tornado, earthquake, and in its way glorious to behold. Mercer wonders if Mother lied to him about the need to repress anger. She lied about everything else. Why not this too? Jack looks at Mercer and says, "Don't be a pussy, bro. Take your shot. She's just a user. A whore like all the other whores. They use you and throw you away like you're an old Kleenex full of snot. Well, they don't throw away Jackie Crockett anymore. I've got my major mojo working. They don't get away with pissing on me anymore. They pay for saying no to Jackie. You like being thrown away, boy? You like being a snot rag, boy? Right now you look as if you like being some whore snot rag. Find your mojo, man." This is not just Jack talking to Mercer. This is also Mercer talking to himself, expressing an anger that has been bottled in him for a long time, and maybe is even present in his blood, in his true father's genes, the anger of a pimp named Dewey Gorton. Mercer looks into Jack's eyes, which are Mercer's eyes, looks into Jack's soul, which is Mercer's soul, and knows himself for the first time. The girl is on the floor struggling to get up, and Mercer kicks her. The first kick makes him sick to his stomach, but the nausea passes. It passes so quickly, in mere seconds. Mercer kicks her again, and when she's eventually dead, the only regret Mercer feels is that they killed the whore in the kitchen instead of in Mother's former bedroom.
7. A sudden wind had come up, and the flying hard-shell beetles tapping at the windows had been chased to their boreholes and their nests. The currents of air buffeting the house and testing the panes of glass sounded wintry, although this was still the warm end of September, and now the muffled clocks couldn't be heard at all. On the farther side of the refrigerator, Gary Burkett stood at the coffee maker, pouring a second cup for himself. Mercer Gossage seemed to want to sell his preference for cold coffee, to eliminate any suspicion that he'd stirred it obsessively because he was nervous. "My mother liked coffee cold. I got a taste for it from her." Across the table from Gossage, Jane said, "I lost my mother, Vanessa, when I was 9. She was a fine pianist. I wanted to be as good as her at the piano, as good as her in all things. Gossage appeared puzzled that she would open her personal life to him. He evidently knew this wasn't standard police procedure. He said,
"Losing a mother is hard at any age, but when you're 9, that would have been a real heartbreaker. No one should have to endure that. I'm sorry to hear it. I'm real sorry."
His sympathy sounded awkward, forced. "Kathy Haskell's mom said you lost your father when you were young." Gossage frowned, no doubt wondering why the murdered girl's mother would have mentioned Vernon Gossage. In fact, she had said only, "Mercer is a sweet man, like his mom was sweet. Nothing like his worthless daddy. Probably was a good thing Uncle Vernon never had much influence on the child. Kathy would have gone off the rails all the way to the end of the line if not for how sweet Mercer was with her, steering her true again." Until Jane had met this man and grown wary of him, Mrs. Haskell's revelation of that bit of family history had seemed of no relevance to the search for the mother-hater. Maybe it still was of no relevance. But it gave her a small lever to pry at Gossage, and intuition said she needed to open his shell and have a look inside.
"I was 16, Gossage said. "My father loved his horses. One of them threw him, broke his neck. I wish I could say I admired him as much as you admired your mother, but he was a very hard man. My mother was an angel, but not him, not Vernon."
He picked up his spoon again and began to stir the brew that remained in his cup. Jane focused on his face as he stared into his cold coffee, and she said, "My mother was murdered. The killer tried to stage it as suicide. I was the one who found her body." In the past, with most people, those words had drawn a look of surprise, even shock, and nearly always sympathy. Gossage didn't at once raise his head to look at her, his brow furrowed as though he might be struggling to understand why she continued with personal disclosures, whether they meant that she was in any way suspicious of him. When he raised his head and looked at her, the slight tremor in his voice would have been appropriate if he'd known her well enough and long enough to have an emotional reaction to the pain that her revelation suggested. But it was odd, considering that they had known each other only half an hour. If he had something to hide, however, then the tack that she'd taken might inspire a tremor of anxiety.
"That's horrible. Dear God. For a little girl to find. That's the hardest thing I've ever heard."
As Gary Burkett turned away from the coffee maker, he seemed to freeze, his attention on the nearer of the two long case clocks. Not the clock. A pegged perf board beside the clock, from which various keys dangle. One of them fixed to a ring bearing the Honda logo. Gary said,
"Mr. Gossage, as a frustrated owner of a Honda, I have to ask, have you ever had transmission problems with yours?"
Gary didn't own a Honda. He drove a Ford Explorer. His wife, Rosalyn, drove a Subaru. However, Kathy Haskell's vintage Honda was still missing. 8.
Using a backhoe, Mercer and the other Mercer, who is Jack, buried Danica deep in what long ago was the hog pen. The farm has not been operative for decades, but Jack finds it fitting and amusing to stow the corpse in ground that he imagines is still rich with the fecal matter of swine. He says, "This is where she belongs, the pig." Jack uses flour, corn flour, powdered brick, gunpowder, and other substances to draw an elaborate voodoo veve on her grave, as Mama Dede taught him. This ensures that she will not be found and that her spirit will not return here to haunt. Things are not the same on Gossage Farm without Danica. It is still summer, but a wintry dreariness settles over the house and land. The days pass without purpose. Mercer was so happy, and now he is not happy at all. On the fifth morning after the girl's death at breakfast, Mercer says, "I wish Danica was still here. It was nice having a pretty girl around." Jack smirked at him. "You wish she was here?" Dug herself out, covered in dirt and pig shit, all broken up and walking dead. "You know what I mean." "Sure, I know. Nice to have Easy Tail around. Something better to look at than you and me and the man in the mirror. Tomorrow I'll go off and find us an even better piece and bring her back." "Just like that?" Mercer says. "Didn't I tell you I've had lots better? You've been a mama's boy too long, bro. You don't know how to score. That's okay. I know the ladies, how they think, what they need. I'll find a juicy one." Mercer is dubious. "And this one you'll find, she'll have a taste for twins." "Danica wasn't unique, bro. I'll get my Dewey Gorton on and go recruiting like our daddy did. You just do some housekeeping, catch up on the laundry while I'm away, and when I get back in a couple days, it'll be party time." Jack is gone 4 days. When he returns in his Chevy van, he has a girl, but it's not the same. She's pretty and all. 20 years old, maybe not much hotter than Danica, but at least as hot. However, she didn't come with Jack of her own free will. She's bound and sedated, and they have to carry her from the van into the house. Her name is Talia, and she is hot, but Mercer is at first a little disappointed because it is not the same. With Danica, they could play cards and watch movies, and she cooked, and they drank together, and she was funny, so there was a romantic quality to it. But Talia is afraid all the time and cries a lot. If they let her roam loose, she'll try to escape. They have to lock her in a room with boarded windows or keep her on a leash with a prong collar. The third day, Jack says, "She won't be like this forever, bro. She'll learn there's no way forward for her except total obedience. Once we break her, she'll be a good little pet and do what we want." "You ever done this before?" Mercer asks. "You ever just stole a girl instead of romancing her?" "Twice before. There's lots of them who can be romanced into doing anything, or they need someone to pay for their drugs. Then once in a while you see a piece so juicy you just got to have her, but she refuses to be romanced and doesn't do drugs, so you need to take drastic action. You can't let nobody say no to you in this world, because once you start letting that happen, it never stops. It's always no, and you're finished." "Seems awful risky. Better to live 10 years as a king than 100 years as a peasant. Take what you want and stomp any bitch or son of a bitch who gets in your way. I got mucho mojo working for me, bro." Over the next 6 weeks, Talia is broken. She is so submissive that they can take the leash and prong collar off her, and she makes no attempt to escape. But for Mercer, it still isn't the same as with Danica. In some ways, it is not as much fun as with Danica, but in other ways, it is more fun. There is such an edge to it. When Mercer wanted Danica, he had to ask her, and sometimes she said, "Not right now," or even, "No." But Talia is not allowed to say no. Talia must do as she's told. Mercer discovers that when a girl must do as she is told, there are many more things you can think to do with her than you would try to do with a girl who could say no. It's a power trip, it really is. There's such an edge to the relationship. That edge is made even sharper by the awareness of how the relationship must end. With Danica, it didn't have to end as it had, if only she had not insulted Jack too often and hadn't said no to him with such scorn. For two reasons, however, there is only one possible end to their relationship with Talia. First, they can never let her go because, unlike with Danica, none of this is consensual. Second, they will inevitably tire of her and be done with her. Jack is right about many things, and he is especially right about variety being the spice of life. Considering all the girls in the thrilling movies that Mercer's mother bought for him, and all the girls in the many movies that he bought for himself after Mother's death, Mercer has had many hundreds of relationships, and he knows how important new faces and new bodies are to keeping the fun in sex. There will be a new girl after Talia, and another after that one. As many as Jack can steal, and the magic will be sustained. This magic is their great destiny, to live like kings with absolute power here in their small kingdom, and never to live as peasants. When the time comes to be rid of Talia, Mercer participates in her disposal without even a moment of passing nausea. Such absolute power is no less exhilarating than sex itself. This is a world of wolves, as Mother said, and it is better to be a wolf than a sheep. They do not beat this girl as they did Danica. There are many ways to be finished with a girl. One thing Mercer learns by experience is that variety in the termination of relationships is as important as variety in the relationships themselves if they're going to be as fulfilling as possible.
9. Standing behind Mercer Gossage, Gary asked if there had ever been transmission problems with the man's Honda. Their host appeared bewildered when he looked up from his cold coffee and met Jane Hawk's eyes. Because Gary had not mentioned the perf board or the keys, because the Honda was in a garage or a barn where they couldn't have seen it, the question initially must have seemed to suggest an almost supernatural knowledge of Gossage's guilt. She saw the confusion quickly give way to a subtle display of apprehension. The creases at the corners of his eyes pleated, and his mouth tightened, and he sat up, slightly straighter, in his chair. Maybe he took 5 seconds to respond, maybe only 4, but Gossage's silence was freighted, full of fevered calculation, before he lowered his gaze to his coffee once more and said,
"Oh, you mean Mother's Honda? Transmission problems? No. She loved that car. It never gave her trouble. She thought it was the best she ever owned. I never drove it, but I'd know if she'd had problems with it. After she died, I took off the tires and put the car up on blocks. It was too old to be worth much if I sold it. And since my own Ford pickup hasn't been as reliable as I'd like, I figured it was a good idea to keep the Honda just in case."
If he had stopped after saying that his mother loved the Honda, he might have sounded innocent and unaware of the loaded nature of Gary's question. But when a guilty man was supremely confident that the scam he'd been selling had a gullible buyer, when he was then rattled by a question, he tended to talk too much, to spin out a rapidly crafted response with a lot of details that he supposed made his answer sound credible. Gary looked at Jane, and she met his eyes, and he put his cup of fresh coffee on the counter. He said,
"Maybe it was your mother's love of Hondas that influenced Kathy Haskell to buy a used one."
Directly across the kitchen from Gary, a pantry door opened, and another Mercer Gossage appeared, armed with a pistol in a 2-hand grip, firing as he came. 10.
It is Jack's idea to send photographs to Talia's mother. One of her daughter, naked and alive, another of her daughter dead. Wouldn't you like to stick a shiv in Brandywine's for throwing us away like a couple snot rags? He asks Mercer, referring to the prostitute who was their biological mother. We send the photos to Talia's mother, it'll be like sticking a shiv in her. The next best thing to cutting Brandy herself. Mercer isn't at once convinced. You said Brandy is still alive. You could cut her for real. As it turns out, when Jack first tracked down Brandy, it didn't go well. He lost his temper and might have cut her then, but she is a tough woman running her own group of whores these days, and she is surrounded by tough people. If Jack goes back there, he's likely to take a bullet for his trouble. Maybe she did us a favor, Mercer says. Maybe if she'd kept us and raised us in that environment, we'd have had shitty lives. Jack Crockett mocks him. Shitty lives? You mean compared to your fabulous, glamorous first 39 years on Gossage Farm with your Iceman father and your lying mother who kept you like a pet and gave you porn movies when you were just 11 and turned you into a jerk-off artist afraid to go after real girls? Mercer has no response. Jack is straight, harder than Mercer, tougher-minded than Mercer, with no capacity for sentimentality. Jack seems so often to get directly to the undeniable truth of things. Mercer has indeed been raised on lies and doesn't always recognize truths as quickly as Jack does. Jack is also one of those wolves in human clothing that Mother often warned Mercer about. The kind Mercer used to fear, though now Mercer wants to be a wolf himself. To live without limits, without laws, without fear of others. Jack is showing his twin the way, and Mercer does not want to alienate Jack by arguing with him. Fact is, Jack says, what could have been better than living in that world, our whore mother's world, with a pimp for our daddy? When we were old enough, Dewey Gordon could have told his girls that it was part of their job to be all over his twin boys. We wouldn't have had to pay for it, not even buy the bitches dinner, and we sure as hell wouldn't have had to steal any damn girls. Because Mercer and Jack can't stick a shiv in Brandywine's without risking a bullet, and because Lenore is dead and beyond harm, they stick a metaphorical shiv in the mother of Talia by sending her the photos. Jack drives all the way to New Jersey to mail them, and to look for a hot girl who will add variety to their lives. Pennsylvania must remain their Switzerland, neutral territory from which they neither steal any girls nor mail photos to grieving mothers. Pennsylvania is called the Keystone State, and it is the keystone of their strategy to avoid drawing suspicion to Gossage Farm. New Jersey is called the Garden State, and Jack says that is because they grow a lot of hot girls there. After Talia, Jack snatches a super cute 16-year-old girl named Lori and sends a photo of her to her mother within a day or two of taking her. Weeks later, when they have finished with Lori, he sends a second shot of the naked corpse. When he does the same thing with the next girl, Sandra, this becomes known as the mother-haters pattern. Thereafter, when each family receives the first photo, their anguish is greatly sharpened during the months that they must wait for picture number two. Jack likes to imagine what torment the families go through. They think they're so special with their nice houses and their education and their good jobs and their polished-up kids going to soccer practice, taking music lessons. But there's nothing special about them that I can't piss on and make it stink for them forever. Jack likes the girls, the sex, the power. But the way he sees it, there's also an element of social justice in what he and Mercer are doing. A balancing of the scales, payment for the injustices the two of them have endured. Sometimes they drink fine whiskey long into the night, talking, sharing, and Jack can often be funny, doing voices and imagining what's happening in the house of the family currently waiting for the second photograph. Jack and Mercer laugh together in these occasions, and it feels good to laugh. Mother never laughed much. Maybe she never laughed at all. Mercer can't quite remember. But laughter is a good thing.
11. Mercer Gossage's double erupted out of the walk-in pantry in a fury, as though jacked up on drugs. A demonic figure with a fiery flush on his face, eyes protruding with hatred and rage, pale lips skinned back from his teeth in a snarl. If he'd been self-controlled, Jane might have been cut down with Gary. But this guy got off on his anger. For him, violence was akin to an orgasm, and he hosed Gary with no regard for the fact that the magazine in his pistol held only 10 rounds. Gary reached to his right hip, to his belt holster, but he didn't get a chance to draw his gun. He took a hard hit, as did the cabinets and refrigerator. Full metal jacket hollow points, a massive first wound. Maybe instant death, and if not, a quick bleed out. The moment the pantry door flew open, Jane started to get up, but the Mercer Gossage who was seated across from her didn't thrust to his feet. Instead, he reached forward and under the table with his right hand, even as his chair stuttered backward slightly on the wood floor, which told her that he had a firearm fixed under the tabletop, held in clamps or a holster. Two men, two weapons, close quarters. That was a scenario with maybe an 80% chance of her ending up dead. In spite of being taken by surprise, she could draw and fire and take out one of them, but not both, before she was cut down. She wasn't fully to her feet yet, and the Mercer from the pantry had fired maybe 3 rounds, and Gary had taken at least one bad hit when Jane put her hands under the table, tipped it up and over and onto the nearer Mercer, overturning his chair with him in it. Maybe the bastard got the concealed gun before the table crashed onto him, maybe not. Gary, sliding down the stainless steel refrigerator door, his face a death mask. The other Mercer still shooting, maybe 4 rounds left in his magazine. Jane, only now, clutching the grip of the pistol in her belt holster. The door to the hall was open and near. She went for it, low and quick. A round shattered a pane of glass in a display cabinet behind her, and another tore a chunk out of the doorframe as she ducked into the hallway, spraying her with splinters. Crossing the threshold, she pulled the swinging door shut behind her. Twins. Kathy Haskell's mother hadn't told her that Mercer had an identical twin, which must mean she didn't know. Somehow, it was Mercer's secret. The mother-hater wasn't one serial killer. He had a kill buddy. They wouldn't come directly after her because there was a chance, however slight, that she might wait for them in a doorway along that narrow hall, which was a shooting gallery. They would expect her to sprint for the car parked in front of the place, and they would come after her from outside, each along a different flank of the house. She didn't have either the time or the inclination to run to the car and get away. Kathy was in the house somewhere. The girl had only been snatched 6 days earlier. She was here, and alive. She couldn't be left to die. Jane opened the front door, but didn't step onto the porch. A warm wind rushed through the screen door, hissing into the foyer. Let them think she had gone outside. Let them waste time searching the night. She turned away from the door as the invading wind pushed it all the way back against the foyer wall, and she ascended 2 steps at a time to the second floor. 12.
For more than 4 years now, Jack brings home fresh girls, a new one every couple of months. He is brilliant at stealing them, nothing less than brilliant. And the hunt for Mother Hater is the longest-running front-page crime story ever, ever, ever. Mercer has found his great destiny, as his mother predicted, the one truth she ever spoke. The clocks are running backward, and the house is outside of time, just like Mama Dede Labrique claimed, which is why the foolish authorities can't find them. The house is outside of time, and they are immune from discovery. They are kings in a world of peasants, The girls are thrilling, more exciting by far than any of those in the porn films. Romance with Danica was nice at the time, but now Mercer understands that romance is just a distraction from the main business, an invention of the weak who are afraid to admit what they really want. Breaking the girls and using them is thrilling. When they are no longer fresh enough to be exciting, the variety of ways they can be killed isn't merely thrilling, but also exactly what they deserve. Because they are all whores who, if they had children, would throw them away like snot rags. Mercer is now dressing like Jack. They both wear black jeans, black t-shirts in warm weather, black and blue plaid flannels in colder months. Their haircuts were similar when Jack first arrived. Now, Mercer and Jack are identically barbered. The more precisely Mercer looks like his twin, the better he feels. The safer he feels, the less alone. They've got their mojo working big time. It's a Friday morning, 10 o'clock, a week after they finished with the most recent girl, and Jack has not yet gone on the hunt again. Kathy Haskell, daughter of Cousin Anita, soon to be returning to college for a new academic year, pays an unannounced visit while Mercer is upstairs in the shower. Kathy has visited before, and Jack has watched her secretly from another room, so he opens the door and lets her in, pretending to be Mercer. He takes her into the kitchen, pours coffee, and sets out a plate of mini-muffins that Mercer has made from one of Mother's recipes. Then Jack excuses himself and hurries upstairs to tell Mercer they have company. Mercer goes downstairs and spends some time with Kathy, pretending to be the same Mercer he was before Jack moved in. When Kathy is gone, the brothers convene in the kitchen. Jack slides the fingertips of one hand back and forth across the seat of the chair in which Kathy has been sitting. "I've said it before, bro, and I'll say it again. I really need a piece of that. She has all the right stuff in the right places." "This is our Switzerland," Mercer reminds him. "Anyway, not her. Never her. Like you don't want her. I don't. Back when she was 14 and you were 38, you spent a lot of time with her. Why?" "Mother and I spent a lot of time with Kathy, both of us, to get her back on the rails. Straighten her out. You didn't once think about getting in her pants?" "No. Bullshit. She's hot now. She must have been delectable then. No matter how hot she was, I didn't need her," Mercer says. "I had my movies." Jack grins and claps his hands. "So you did want to get in her pants. You wanted it so bad. I bet you spent hours and hours with your freaking movies, and every girl in them looked like her to you." Jack can't be deceived. He sees right through people, sees the truth of them. Jack would have seen the truth of Mother in a minute, the truth Mercer had not been able to see while Mother was alive. Mercer says, "Kathy flaunted it then. She was a tease. That's one of the ways she was off the rails. Boys were too important to her, and that's the way she got them interested." "Just another whore," says Jack. "She's off limits, Jack. She's family." "Her mother, Anita Haskell, is your cousin, huh?" "You know she is. And Anita's mother was my Aunt Gladys, my father's sister, which you also know. You said Gladys never wanted much to do with you and your mother, and neither did your cousin Anita. That's why Kathy would talk to us, because Mother and me, we weren't Anita and Gladys. We were different from them. You said it was you, not your mother so much, that turned Kathy around. Because I became like a father figure to her. Anita is a single mother. Kathy never had a dad in her life." "At 14, she was a real tease, huh? Did she tease you? A man 24 years older than her? Come on to you, flirt, touch your arm, your hand, your knee, and let her fingers linger. Yeah, well, but it didn't work with me, so she started to respect me. Jack laughs. Didn't work? I'm sure you remember telling me a minute ago she got you mega horny, but you didn't need her because you had your movies. You spent hours with your movies, and all the girls in them looked like her to you. I didn't say it that way. You did, because it's true. You wanted her, all right, but you couldn't have her because you were your mama's gutless eunuch. Real girls scared you. 38 and scared of real girls. Good thing I helped you put an end to that before you died of boredom. And here's something else to think about, bro. Your Aunt Gladys and Cousin Anita aren't family. Neither is Kathy. They aren't anything to you. Your family is a dead pimp and a burnt-out old whore who's turned herself into a female pimp. And me. Me. I'm your real family.
13. Gary Burkett, dead. Father-to-be, wedded only 2 years earlier. Rosalind Burkett, carrying a child who would be born fatherless, born into its mother's grief. This sucked. It stank. But Jane could not allow herself anger yet, or grief. Anger and grief would interfere with clear thinking, get in the way of survival. Faint light filtered up the stairs from the foyer, but the second-floor hall was as shadowy as a catacomb, the rooms to both sides as dark as cadaver vaults. She could suppress anger and grief, but she couldn't entirely quash fear. Some fear was good. It sharpened the senses. Long case clocks stood on both sides of the hall, as if they were death's hooded lieutenants, their arcing pendulums like scythes ready for the reaping. She sheltered between two of them, her back to the wall, head forward just far enough to look past the clock on her left and watch the head of the stairs. She tried her iPhone. No service. This was farm country, and she was a long way from a cell tower. In the kitchen, there had been a wall phone. A landline down there suggested a landline up here, most likely in the master bedroom. Find it. Call local law enforcement for backup. Then locate Kathy Haskell. Defend her until sheriff's deputies arrived in force. She couldn't hear anything but wind rattling the screen door down in the foyer, buffeting the walls of the house, keening across the roof. Creaks and pops of stressed joinery settled on her from the raftered attic. She stepped out from between the clocks, holding the iPhone at her side, aiming it at the floor, using it as a flashlight, fingers occluding part of the screen to minimize the risk that the killers seeking her outside might glimpse a ghostly radiance moving across a window. She found the master bedroom, a phone on a nightstand. Dial tone. She keyed in the 3 digits on the nightstand phone, switched off her smartphone, stood in the dark. She didn't bother giving her location. It was already on the 911 operator's screen. Keeping her voice low, she identified herself, reported Gary down, ID'd Mercer Gossage and his twin as the killers. Catherine Haskell is alive somewhere here. Get me backup, fast.
Backup's rolling. Stay on the line with me.
Fuck that. If I don't move, I'm dead. The operator started to say something, and then was gone. As if someone had cut the phone line coming into the house. As Jane hung up the handset, light bloomed in the upstairs hall beyond the bedroom door. 14.
And me. Me, says Jack. I'm your real family. Jack is not just making a pitch to snatch Kathy Haskell. He is making this a non-negotiable condition for the continuation of his and Mercer's magical life together. Jack badly wants Kathy, and Jack always takes what he wants. Taking what he wants and never taking no for an answer is how he defines himself, and if that is no longer who he is, then he's lost. He's nobody. Mercer knows this is reckless, but Jack is always reckless, and it works for him. He's almost 44, and he's skated through a lawless life without one arrest. In addition to Danica, he's brought 21 girls to the farm over 4 years, tormented 21 families, and during his hunts, he hasn't once come close to being caught. Jack is charmed. Mama Dede Labrique has inoculated him against arrest and prosecution. That's what Jack believes, and no reason has been presented to suggest that he is wrong. Yet Mercer is worried. Mercer goes outside and stands in the yard and slowly turns in a circle. Turns in a circle again. Under the deep and profoundly empty sky, surveying the hundreds of fallow acres. Loneliness, a sense of being the only human being left on Earth, and isolation from all meaning and purpose swell within him at the mere prospect of Jack's permanent departure. He imagines being alone in the house at night, with no girl in the cellar to use, with no company but that of the 21 dead girls buried in the former hog pen. Without bold, exciting Jack at his side, Mercer will become a middle-aged nothing, as dull as ever he'd been before Jack arrived. Jack is the only family Mercer has or ever will have, and family is everything.
15. Groaning wind at the windows, enshrouding darkness throughout the bedroom. Sudden light in the hallway. Jane with her Glock 19M in a two-hand grip. The switch for the hallway lights might be in the first floor foyer, or it might be at the head of the stairs, in which case at least one of the killers was already on the second floor. If they had gone outside, they had returned sooner than Jane anticipated. They knew there was no cell phone service. Maybe they came back so quickly because they realized she might be seeking a landline. The hard roar of a shotgun reverberated off the walls as if they were drum membranes. Here, on the second floor, toward the front of the residence. Glass shattered, wood cracked, buckshot rattled off metal. At once, another round followed the first. What was he doing? He wasn't shooting in fright at shadows and phantoms. People who kidnapped 21 girls and got away with it for 4 years weren't the type given to panic. A third round shook the walls. A fourth. A fifth. Those three seemed to come from elsewhere than the first two, perhaps from the east rather than the west side of the hall. He was clearing rooms. This wasn't how Jane had been taught to clear rooms at Quantico, when, as an agent, you had to be concerned about the safety of innocents, about rules of engagement, but it might be how a homicidal sociopath cleared rooms when he had a lot of ammunition and didn't give a rat's ass about collateral damage. There was nowhere in the master bedroom for her to take a protected shooter's position and nail him when he came through the doorway. A volley of buckshot would precede him. Evidently, he was also shooting into closets, bathrooms, into any adjacent space in which he thought she might be hiding, which is why the blasts were coming in groups of 2 and 3. The shotgun probably had a 3 or 5 round magazine, plus one in the breech. He'd spend one round from the hallway, chop the room with buckshot, enter with 3 or 5 more rounds ready. As the 12-gauge roared, Jane slipped through the darkness to the rectangle of moonlit glass. After a 2-second silence, during which she twisted open the lock on the double-hung window, the weapon boomed again. If the window was painted shut, she was dead before backup could get here. The bottom sash slid up easily, wind in her face, its 10,000 voices whispering in her ears. Beyond lay the back porch roof. She eased through the opening, pulled the sash shut, stepped to one side, and pressed her back to the clapboard wall. Glock in both hands, muzzle toward the night sky. Intervening rooms had somewhat muffled the shotgun fire, so she wasn't temporarily deaf from the volume of sound, but she couldn't hear clearly either. Her pounding heart sounded strangely distant, like the ominous cloven hoofbeats of a predatory beast in a dream, forever circling her just beyond the limits of vision. To her right, a shotgun blast shattered the window, and in the aftermath of the muzzle flare, the killer switched on the bedroom lights. 16.
During Kathy Haskell's drop-in visit, she mentions that she is spending the night with a high school friend, Lisa Schuster, on the Schuster family dairy farm and leaving from there for college at 8 o'clock in the morning. Having lived largely in the isolation of mother's love, Mercer doesn't know the Schusters or the location of their operation, but in a few minutes on the internet, he finds them. At 7:30 a.m., Mercer is in his Ford pickup, parked along the two-lane county road 3 miles south of the Schuster place. At a few minutes before 8, he gets out of the truck and puts up the hood and pretends to be troubleshooting a breakdown, though, in fact, he is watching the southbound lane for the first sign of Kathy's 10-year-old Honda. She is a punctual girl, always has been, even when she was 14 and going off the rails, and she shows up at 8:06. As she approaches, Mercer slams the hood, contriving to appear annoyed and distracted, moving to the driver's door of the truck, not paying attention to the approaching car. She taps her horn and pulls off the road in front of the pickup. Mercer bends down to the driver's window, expressing surprise at this fortuitous encounter. Because Kathy knows that he is not familiar with the Schuster family, she believes he doesn't realize they live only 15 minutes from Gossage Farm, and she finds this crossing of paths innocent, serendipitous. Mercer gives her some flim-flam about a cracked distributor cap. She knows that he repairs his own vehicles, so it's credible when he says he has a spare cap at home. Because they are still in a zone without cell service, Mercer asks if she could drive him to his place, where he can grab the part he needs, and then return him to the broken-down pickup. Because Mercer spent so much time talking sense to her 6 years earlier, Kathy is happy to oblige. They are together at the roadside perhaps a minute. No traffic passes in that time. No one has seen them together. During the ride to Gossage Farm, Mercer is amazed as he listens to himself chat with Kathy, as if he has no foul play in mind. He is so smooth at this. He thinks, I have become Jack, and this greatly pleases him. She doesn't mind being delayed half an hour or more to aid him because she feels that she owes him. He feels that he owes her, too. Owes her for the way she teased him back in the day. Came on to him with her eyes and her straying hand and all the wiles of her body, when he was merely Mercer and too weak to take advantage of what she offered. She had at times laughingly mocked Mercer for his timidity, and he owes her for that as well. As they draw near the farm, a savage glee swells in Mercer, an almost rapturous feeling of absolute power. Breaking Kathy and using her will be a special pleasure. But Mercer suddenly understands that killing her will be even more thrilling than the sex, because she is the last remaining reminder of the feeble, timid fool that he had once been. When Kathy is dead and buried in the hog pen, Mercer will have erased his past, and he will be entirely, entirely as ruthless as Jack. The empty sky and the fallow land will not disturb him any more, and he will never be alone because there will be Jack, and there will be an endless series of girls, with the clocks and the counterclocks stalling the flow of time in the timeless bubble that is Gossage Farm. Kathy parks beside the barn in which Mercer maintains his mechanics shop. When she disengages her safety harness and switches off the engine to wait for him, he distracts her by saying, "There's something I need to say to you. Something I've wanted to say for a long time." She regards him with interest and is frozen in shock for a moment when he says, "You're a totally hot bitch." Which is precisely when Jack pulls open the driver's door and grabs her by the hair and pulls her, screaming from behind the wheel. There is no one to hear her scream except Mercer and Jack, who are wildly excited by it. Jack gets an arm around Kathy's neck and drags her to the ground while Mercer runs around the Honda with the zip ties that he will use to bind her wrists and ankles. When Kathy is locked in a room in the cellar, Mercer pulls the Honda into the barn. Jack drives his Chevy van with Mercer aboard to where the Ford pickup was left alongside the county road. In separate vehicles, the brothers come home to their glorious destiny.
17. Jane, on the porch roof, back pressed to the clabbered wall, the wind rushing down out of the moon and seeming to shimmer the lunar glow through the turbulent night. The window exploding into the wind, sudden light in the bedroom. Another roar. Shotgun pellets ripping through something inside, maybe through the flimsy sliding doors to the closet. The weapon booming again, probably clearing the ensuite bath where the door had been standing half open, a ringing cascade of bathroom mirrors dissolving from the walls to the floor. In extreme circumstances, she took crazy risks because the odds said that crazy was, in that situation, rational. If the odds were backed up with a flash of intuition, she moved fast, using what she had learned at Quantico. But she didn't allow by-the-book rules to override her gut. Her pounding heart shook her arms. Bite on the fear. The sloped roof didn't permit her preferred shooting stance, but with the 9mm Glock and a two-hand grip, she stepped boldly into the outfall of light and saw Mercer Gossage, or his twin, starting to turn away from the bathroom toward the hallway door. He saw her, too, and swung toward the blown-out window. The orange post of the Ameriglow gun sight was radiant in the low moonlight, and she squeezed off four shots, 147-grain Speer Gold Dot G2 rounds, three hits. The shotgun fell from the killer's hands with his last shell still chambered. With a wheezy gasp of shock, as though his mortality surprised him, he staggered backward and fell and curled on his side in the fetal position, clutching the right side of his abdomen to staunch the blood spurting between his fingers. He screamed in agony as Jane climbed through the lower sash, careful not to snag herself on the remaining shards of glass. Although she didn't want to put the murderous bastard out of his misery, wanted him to suffer as his victims suffered. His screams masked whatever sounds his brother might be making, so she booted him onto his back and shot him point-blank through the heart. His left hand slipped off the wound, which ceased spurting when his heart stopped, and Jane saw that his right hand was pressed not to the torn flesh, but instead to the pistol in his belt holster. He had lacked the strength and clarity of mind to use it. For a few seconds, crossing the room, eyes fixed on the open door to the hallway, she heard nothing but the ringing in her ears, the wind keening at the broken-out window, and her tom-tom heart pounding the rhythm of mortal dread. Then the other twin shouted from downstairs, "Jack? What the fuck? What's happening, Jack? Jack? Jack!" So it was Mercer below. She eased through the doorway and looked toward the stairs. He wasn't coming up. He let out a long, despairing cry, chilling and childlike in its shrillness, revealing that he was moving out of the foyer and along the hallway toward the kitchen. Jane ejected the magazine from the Glock, in which only four rounds remained, dropped it in a pocket of her sport coat, snapped a fresh magazine into the pistol, and moved toward the stairs. Kill buddies were rare, though not unprecedented. Emotionally bonded sociopaths. The cruelty of the one inflamed the violent passions of the other in a feedback loop that excited them to ever more outrageous abuses of their victims. Jane, on the stairs, careful not to take a fall. The banister on her right, but of no use to her because her right arm was her gun arm. Glock, just under her line of vision, the steps seeming to rise and fall like waves over the Ameriglow gun sight. Mercer had stopped screaming. He might be coming back. Jane, breathing through her mouth, pressure on the trigger, eyes fixed on the landing. Then, on the span of stairs from the landing to the apparently deserted foyer. The feedback loop between bonded sociopaths might be only a fraction as intense as that between sociopaths who were identical twins. In either case, this isolated property would have become a bubble universe to them, the rest of the world a mere virtual reality game in which they hunted women. Clocks running forward, running backward, their universe outside of time, with only two stars, Mercer and Jack, each orbiting the other, each dependent on the other's light. Now, one of them a dead star, the other collapsing into a black hole. When Jane reached the foyer, Mercer's despairing cry rose again, not from the back of the house, but from below, the cellar. And then, a woman's scream. Mercer's fury, fear, and hate were of such gravity that what remained of his corrupted soul was being torn and crushed and sucked into an outer dark beyond mere darkness. Less than an hour ago, he had been an all-powerful ruler of his universe, but now his only power was to kill one more victim. Jane ran along the hallway, heedless of the rooms to either side, burst into the kitchen, and saw what must be the cellar door near the pantry. Locked. She shot out the lock, yanked open the door. Concrete block walls, wooden steps with rubber runners, light below. Neither Mercer nor Catherine Haskell screaming now. He, silent. She, sobbing and pleading for her life. Jane descended. 18. The scent of mildew. Low raftered ceiling. Oil-fired furnace. Water heater. Two overhead LED bulbs in cone shades. The sky blue wall against which the mother-hater photographed the naked girls, a webbed and spidered place of focused light and sinuous shadows. Jane thought of sweet Nick and precious Travis, husband and son, her reasons to be bold but not reckless, reasons to live. And she thought of Vanessa, her murdered mother, her reason for being here at all, for choosing the law over music, justice over safety. Ahead, a steel door stood ajar, separating the first room from a second. A different quality of light beyond that threshold, a bit brighter but amber rose. Kathy's trembling voice, "Please don't! Please don't! Please! Please! Oh God! Please!" Jane took cover behind the doorframe, at the side with the hinges. Peering through the gap between door and jamb, she saw a nightstand, a lamp with a tasseled shade that was the source of part of the light, a portion of an unmade bed. But there was no sign of the killer or his captive. She called the troll's name. "Mercer Gossage? Come watch me kill this slut," he shouted. "It's over, Mercer." "Over for you. Over for this whore I've got here. I called for backup." "You lying pig. You didn't have time. I cut the phone line." "Jack is dead." "Better go look again, bitch. Jack wears two wristwatches."
So fucking what?
Mama Dee Dee's New Orleans voodoo watch. He'll live forever.
The twins' bubble universe was constructed with elements of magical thinking, not uncommon among homicidal sociopaths. There should be a way to use that against him. How?
Come on! Come in! Come watch me blow the brains out of this dirty little tease!
He had been the cruel master of his isolate world, in his mind as powerful as a god. Now his potency evaporated, and he raged in denial of his reduced circumstances. The only proof he had that his reign had not drawn to an end was his power to kill one more woman. But he evidently needed Jane to witness his Olympian authority, maybe because he thought that proving his continued ability to play the executioner would magically undo what change she had wrought in his universe, would reinflate the bubble and restore his godlike might, resulting in her death as well.
Come in and watch me kill this snotty college slut. What are you afraid of, bitch? Afraid of being buried in the hog pen with the others? You will be. You will be. Jack and I will piss in your grave before we close it up. Come look. Come see. Come know.
Backup from the thinly staffed sheriff's department might take 12 to 15 minutes to get there, which meant she would be on her own for another nerve-rattling 7 minutes or more. But now, she abruptly dreaded hearing the approaching sirens, because that sound might bring home to Mercer Gossage the truth of his situation, deflate his faith in magic, whereupon he might forego a witness and kill Kathy Haskell for sheer spite. In a voice raw and demonic and hot with impatience, Gossage shouted,
"Get in here, you stupid twat! Watch me do it! Watch me, bitch! Watch me!"
Judging by what Jane could see of the chamber beyond the threshold, it was longer than the one in which she stood, maybe 30 feet from the door to the back wall. It would almost surely be about 40 feet wide, as was this front room. Gossage wasn't going to be near the door. He'd be holding the girl against him in a far corner, the gun to her head. As long as he used Kathy as his shield, Jane wouldn't have a clear shot at him. On the other hand, he wasn't trained at Quantico, wasn't top of the class in marksmanship, and at a distance of 30 feet, an inexperienced gunman would miss more often than hit his target. Kathy cried out in pain and terror,
"He's biting! He's biting me!"
Immobility leads to a collapse of nerve, to failure, to death. Get off the X. If you move, you live. You save lives. Pistol in a two-hand grip, Jane shouldered open the door and went into the rape room, low and fast. 19. Jane, through the door, block in front of her, taking in the entire scene at once. Amber rose lamplight, a bed with disheveled sheets, an armchair, a toilet, a sink, two walls mirrored floor to ceiling. In the farther corner, the kidnapped girl, wearing only panties, Gossage behind her, his left arm around her neck, gun in his right hand, its muzzle hard against her temple. A cruel bite mark in the muscle of her right shoulder, blood oozing down her breast, blood on Gossage's mouth and chin, teeth glistening in a fierce grin. He intended the bite to draw Jane into the room, and here she was. In fact, two Janes, herself and her image in one mirror. She didn't like how frightened she looked, a sheen of sweat on her brow. Gossage was maybe 7 or 8 inches taller than Kathy, head exposed above the girl's right shoulder. But he rocked from side to side and forced her to sway with him. Jane couldn't risk a shot. She took another step into the room. The muzzle of Gossage's pistol slid from Kathy's temple to her jaw, and the killer warned Jane.
"Come an inch closer. I blow off this whore's jaw. Scatter her teeth and chunks of her tongue all over the room. Let her bleed out. Let her know excruciating pain. Because you took an inch.
Jane said, tell me what I can do to stop this.
Nothing.
You want something from me, or you'd already have done it.
I want you to stand there, bitch. Stand right there until Jack comes up behind you. Then you can watch me kill her. And 2 seconds later, he'll blow your head off. And everything will be like it was.
Jack is dead.
Liar. Liar, liar, liar! The clocks are ticking. You brought some way bad mojo into the house, but the clocks are ticking. Some forward, some backward. And you're no Mama Didi. You're just a dumb twat with a badge.
4 years of holding absolute power over 21 girls. 4 years of indulging every demented fantasy of rape and torture. 4 years of committing one atrocity after another, with never a negative consequence, had convinced him that Gossage Farm was a world unto itself, where no transgression would be punished. However, sirens were imminent. When he heard the sirens, the last of his delusions would expire. His pent-up rage and hatred, purified and intensified through years of violence, was like a brick of C4 explosive, waiting for an electric spark. When Mercer Gossage detonated, he'd take the girl out with him rather than die alone. Jane had to do something to change the situation, play to his need to hold fast to his fool's paradise. She said, "Kill me instead." His grin settled into a contemptuous sneer.
What shit is this?
Let her go, and I'll die for her.
I'm supposed to believe... What? You're some saint with great tits?
Somehow she had to craft this moment so that it flowed with the fluid strangeness of a dream. Mercer Gossage had been living a dream for years. A nightmare for his victims, but a fantasy of supernatural power for him. And lulling him into that waking dream state might make him overconfident and prone to miscalculation. She said, "Clocks are ticking forward and backward, right? There's no time here, right? Death doesn't happen here. You kill me and I still live, right?" Lank with sweat, his hair fell into his face as he swayed back and forth with his hostage, and he shook his head.
It doesn't work that way.
So how's it work?
It only works that way for me and Jack. He has the voodoo watch, and I have mother's clocks, and you don't have either. You have nothing.
I think it works for me. In fact, I know it does.
Did it work for all the sluts buried in the hog pen? Go out there and ask those rotting whores if it worked for them. It only works for me and Jack.
Let her go, Jane repeated, and I'll die for her.
You must think I'm as brain dead as you are.
Jane slowly lowered the Glock. She tossed it onto the unmade bed. The gun landed on the pillows, too far for her to reach it easily. He regarded her with disbelief.
You're one crazy fucking bitch.
Something's happening to me. Something weird, but good. I feel all the clocks ticking, Mercer. I feel them in my bones. She took a step toward him. Don't you feel them ticking in your bones? In your blood? They're ticking, ticking. Ticking inoculates me against time and aging and death. Kathy Haskell wept, either pleading with Mercer or warning off Jane.
No, 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 no!
Don't you hear Mama Dede, Mercer? Her sweet black voice, soul of the bayou? I feel the clocks in my bones, and I hear Mama Dede whispering all the way from out there in New Orleans.
You don't know Mama Dede. You don't hear anything.
Jane took another step. I'm not like the girls in the hog pen. I'm meant to be here as much as you and Jack are, to live outside of time.
You said Jack is dead.
I thought he was. I really did. But now, I know he's not. I feel the ticking and I feel Jack rising. She took another step, aware that she now cast two reflections, one ahead of her, another in the mirrored wall to her left. Mercer's back was against the first mirror, so he cast a reflection only in the second. Three Janes, two Mercers. She dared not take another step yet.
There's three of me. Do you see? Kill me here, and I'll still live there. Kill me there, and the third me still lives. Kill the third, and I'll come alive here again, under the spell of the clocks.
Without Jack at his side, Mercer's magical thinking was not easily sustained. But now that Jane professed a newfound faith in the power of the clocks, and threw away the Glock to prove it, Mercer seemed to feel a renewed hope. He was desperate to believe that his bubble universe could be reinflated, and his desperation combined with his confusion made him vulnerable. The muzzle of the pistol remained against Kathy's jaw.
"You're scamming me," he said,
but it sounded more like a question than an accusation.
"This cheap slut doesn't belong here, Mercer.
I belong here." She opened the top button on her untucked blouse. "You and Jack and I belong here, but she's just another piece of ass." Jane opened the second button, the third, dared to take another step, and her fear swelled. His mind was a snake's nest of uncountable sexual depravities, writhing with violent desires. And intuition told Jane to play to that part of him no less than to his serpent's knot of squirming superstitions. His gaze fixed on the fullness of her breasts and the cups of her bra.
"You could be Danica. Nothing's been the same here since Danica. Are you Danica?"
Jane had no idea who Danica might be. Whether it was safe or dangerous to allude to being an incarnation of her. "What do you think, Mercer? Does Danica belong here?"
"Yeah. It was different with her."
"Then kill me and see if I belong here. If I belong here, I can't be killed. And I know I belong here. I'm taking no risk at all. Kill me, Mercer, and live here with me." His expression was that of a man born on the vapors of a perplexing but enchanting dream. As Jane closed to within 10 feet of him, he turned his pistol away from Kathy. Jane opened the last button on her blouse. "Kill me." The barrel of his weapon swung toward her. She put her hand on the grip of Jack's pistol, which she had tucked in the waistband of her jeans, under her blouse. Mercer moved in the laconic flow of a dream of power. Jane moved with the fast-forward efficiency learned in Quantico. She firing point-blank in his face, he reflexively squeezing off a round that singed her hair as it passed a millimeter from her skull. She cried out, "Shit, shit, shit!" as he collapsed backward into the corrupted sludge that had once occupied his head and that now slid down the mirror. Sirens wailed. Kathy fled the corpse, rushed into her rescuer's arms. Holding the terrified girl, Jane couldn't tell which of them was shaking the most, although she, unlike Kathy, wasn't trembling with residual terror, but with relief and gratitude. And with a humbling awareness that she hadn't failed this girl as, so many years ago, she had failed to ensure justice for her mother. However, as she helped Kathy dress, Jane's joy was tempered hard by the loss of Gary. Fine man, good partner, friend, by the thought of Rosalind left alone, and by an awareness that what this young girl had suffered during the past 6 days would weigh upon her for the rest of her life. Upstairs, on their way to meet the county sheriff's deputies, they stepped out of the house into a warm night, into wind scented with honeysuckle under a sky diamonded with a vast wealth of stars, into the moonlit world in all its stunning beauty, which even the endless evil done by the worst of humankind could not soil or diminish.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Bone Farm, a Jane Hawke case file by Dean Koontz, performed by Elizabeth Rogers and James Anderson Foster. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing Incorporated, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.